I think it's a privilege to call yourself a tequila-ologist, and it's something you have to earn. And because a tequila-ologist does, he or she has the ability to create new and better realities and improve conditions. You can really avoid those DUIs, and it's just like, that's it. It's something that I don't mince words with. Being a tequila-ologist, when you drive past an accident, it's not like anyone else. It's you drive past and you have to do something about it. You really have to know that it wasn't you who caused that accident. You weren't behind the wheel. You weren't drinking. But it could be you. That's what drives me.
Okay, so I am here with Jamie Attenberg, who is the author of The Kept Man. Jamie, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. You're the first 2008 interview. The first question, actually, I wanted to ask you is, this book seemed to me a very intriguing hybrid of both the Grups from Adam Sternberg's article in New York, mm-hmm. as well as Terry Schiavo. So I'm wondering, did these strike specific points of inspiration for you to concoct this narrative, or...
Well, it was like, it's usually a really organic experience for me, or process, when I begin a book. So I actually started with the Grups. I'm not that familiar with that term. What is it?
Grups. There was this big brouhaha. In fact, Neil Pollack, who I noticed that you had in the acknowledgments section, yes. he was actually quoted in the article. It's basically the short for grown-ups. It comes from a Star Trek episode, and Adam Sternberg wrote this long article bemoaning those who are in their 30s, who the alternative dads and that kind of thing.
Oh, like the grown-up yuppie.
Exactly.
Things. Oh, yeah. So I guess it kind of started with the three kept men in the book. I really just wanted to write about them, and I was really noticing a lot of people around Williamsburg, where I live, and they just seemed to have a lot of time on their hands. And then I started meeting men who had much wealthier wives, and they are all sort of artistic and vaguely pursuing their craft. And so I became fascinated with that. And then the whole Terry Schiavo thing was happening at the exact same time that I started writing the book. And they just, for some reason, came together. I don't know why. And like, I just started like adding one layer on top of another layer. And, it is really like fascinating to walk around this neighborhood in the cafes. As a writer, you go out a lot. So, and I just wonder what these people do all day long. I mean, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah. It's interesting that you actually drew from personal experience as opposed to this article, but I'm wondering why you had the men be this particular type of men. There are generally two types of men in this book. Of course, the Kept Men's Club is also, as well as the art world as well.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering why you chose to have this particular type of man as opposed to someone who was perhaps in between, in the gray area of the dichotomy.
I don't know. I was just more interested in men being weaker, I suppose, than women.
Yeah. Okay.
That appeals to me.
Well, how did Jarvis come about from this organic process?
Well, Jarvis is really, when I was sort of coming up, when I was younger and first started coming to New York, I had a lot of friends who worked in the club scene and who worked in bars and who went to art school. So I guess she's inspired by a bunch of women that I know who, at least from at her core, or where she came from. But then she just sort of came out of that. I don't know who she, you know, where she is, but as soon as I knew her, I had met her, you know. But she didn't, she's not inspired by anyone specifically. Mm. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, well, you did in a certain way. I mean, I'm wondering also about the Terry Schiavo narrative, because it does actually play in more later in the book than in the beginning of the book. Mm-hmm. Did you know immediately that there was this kind of almost quasi-allegory feel to that, or did it start with the fact that we had Martin Miller in this coma?
It started with Martin being in a coma. I knew that. Actually, the first chapter that I wrote in the book was about the donut girls in Greenpoint.
Oh, interesting.
That was the first thing, because I wanted to write about a little bit about the art world too. I knew that. And then I knew that there was this man that was in a coma. I wanted to do that, but I didn't know how it was going to end. But I say this, I've said this before, that when you have a guy in a coma, when you set sort of the stakes really high like that, like there's only three ways that it can possibly end, which is that he dies or he wakes up or somebody kills him. Or he just keeps sort of floating along, I suppose, but that wouldn't be a very good ending to a book now, would it?
Yeah.
So I didn't know about the more political stuff until I just really got to the end of the book. I don't want to give away the ending, though.
No, we're not.
But it just sort of, I mean, I really have no idea when I start writing a book how it's going to end at all, so.
So you actually kind of had sort of a mishmash here. You jumped from point A to point 6 to point Z, et cetera, throughout the course of this, and that's kind of how you stumble upon the narrative with this?
It's really, the first two books I wrote were, which is the second book, I wrote in about a year. So everything's, like I said, it's very organic. I'm just sort of picking up things that are around me and putting them into a book. And then eventually when you get to the end, you filter out like what worked and what didn't work.
Okay, well, Davis and the Donut Girls, if this was one of the key starting points, was this a kind of imagined experience, or was this drawn from anything specific that you observed? Because I'm certainly not familiar with this phenomenon.
With Donut Girls?
Yeah.
Well, you have to live in this neighborhood, because it's more like north side, like this side. We're on the south side right now, and we're doing this interview in my apartment, we should mention. And on the south side, it's like very Hasidic and Puerto Rican and Dominican. And then when you head towards to more the north side and towards Greenpoint, then it's really Polish over there. So you notice the Polish girls that are out there in the world. And people are really, some people are really fascinated and obsessed with them because they're beautiful young women. They're recent immigrants and they're, you know, definitely a force in the population.
Well, I'm wondering though, why donut shops in particular? It seemed a very...
There is a donut shop on Greenpoint, in Greenpoint on Manhattan Avenue, and it just stuck in my brain. I think I went there one night, like after seeing a rock show, and so it just stuck. So it's sort of like that donut shop, and it just kind of stuck in my head. I always wanted to write about it.
Did you observe any specific pickup artists there?
No, I don't even know if people really do pick them up, but it was just in my imagination that they did, so...
Huh, interesting. Or even someone constantly buying clothes and this whole modeling thing going in and escalating into something else. This was the imagined part then.
This is like, but that's no different than Jarvis wanting to be taken care of or these men wanting to be taken care of. Like, there are these people in the world who look to other people to, sponsor them or meet their needs, but they provide something in return. I missed the point that I wanted to make, which is that after I like sort of had all these ideas about all these characters and plot points, and I came across the idea of being kept or held back. And once I realized that that was going to be the title of the book and that was a major theme, then it was really easy to go back, to move forward and to go back eventually and make sure that every character has something that's holding them back or keeping them in their life. And that's where it comes from.
Gotcha. Going back to this issue of topography as a sort of launching point, it's reminiscent to me of Nabokov's rule, where he basically said that he could not write a novel until he actually had a particular location. Likewise, in addition to this inspirational sort of moment, I wanted to first of all find out if this was actually a factor for you in actually writing this. And it also kind of leads into another question about Jarvis's perspective, where she's often, I can even read particular sorts of situations, but she's generally taking a small item and putting it into context with kind of the larger neighborhood. Like, for example, there's a pack of cigarettes that she observes, and she's very clear in the way that she describes it as coming from a particular deli and how it was actually purchased and the like. So I wanted to sort of ask you about this kind of phenomenon in your book. Was this a sort of way for you to kind of generate momentum in your book and to sort of at least... you needed to get the lay of the land before you can get the lay of the characters?
I live here. I've lived here for 5 years, and I've lived in New York for 10 years. So for me, it's not conscious in any sort of way. It was just, I wanted to write about the neighborhood that I lived in. And I take a lot of pictures. I go out a lot to document, and I have a blog, and so I write about have been writing about the neighborhood a lot. So for me, it was just a really natural, I don't know, it's not a conscious thing. I would love to take credit for it being some sort of conscious, deliberate act on my part. But I'm pretty I just write about the world around me. But I did feel like at that moment when I was writing the book that there was so much going on in Williamsburg that, I mean, this is a rapidly gentrifying neighborhood. And it also felt like, thematically, it did feel perfect for Jarvis, because Jarvis needs to sort of break out of something. And Williamsburg was sort of very quietly becoming something, and then all of a sudden it burst out and there was all this development, and people were really concerned with its development, and And I think people in this book suddenly become very concerned with Martin Miller's life as well. So,
well, concerning this gentrification, you have Jarvis fleeing almost like the Trail of Tears to across the river, and yet she is very taken with, for example, bagel shops, the laundromat as a kind of social nexus, as well as finding comforts in the very locations that she often despises. So I'm wondering, how, when did you know that this was kind of coming up? Did this come about from knowing the neighborhood, or really sort of as an extension of Jarvis's consciousness?
I think that just if you're going to write a true New York story, you have to write about all of these little shops and stores. We don't know our neighbors a lot of the time. Our friends tend to live really far away from us, or it's not convenient. It's not like you can walk down the street and knock on someone's door and see them. So it becomes really crucial that you have these relationships with the person at your bodega or the laundromat. It's just a really interesting community. And in Williamsburg, when there's so many different kinds of people here, and there was this big, you know, influx of young people who really like to engage, it just seems really natural to think. I don't know. That's just my version of New York.
Sounds like it very much is a topographical sort of concentration here, then.
But she's not me. But it's just how I think someone like her would. I certainly identify with her. I don't think I've ever done anything that she's done before, and I've certainly never had anyone support me financially. That'd be really nice if that happened. Nor have I ever, been married or had a loved one of any sort in a coma. So, but if you're of a certain age and you have a certain lifestyle, you depend on the outside world in New York.
Did you use any specific aspects of the real art world for this to draw upon, or was much of this kind of invented? I mean, it sort of struck me as a more sort of subdued, painted word kind of approach to these various people who are really kind of being opportunistic about Martin Miller legacy. So,
I think that, I mean, definitely I've been to my share of art world parties. Definitely I've dated artists. I've never, I'm a writer. I have an editor, so I understand what it's like to have somebody who watches over you and makes sure you're, doing the right thing with your career, and have an agent and things like that. So I think I understand that mindset. I've never, certainly not spent an inordinate amount of time in the inner workings of the art world. But I was inspired by different visual artists and their work. And sorry, my cat's jumping up right now.
He likes me, yes. No worries.
So I was inspired. I mean, I feel like I've done. I did the research on it. You know.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to also ask you about some of the phrasing of Jarvis. She says, for example, "I feel like I want a divorce," not "I want a divorce." Also, she describes the photos that Martin takes, but she is never really able to find a kind of causative relationship. It's largely kind of something that she sort of has to imagine. This notion, then, of having something not entirely literal or something that's not entirely decisive, the passive nature of her existence.
Sure.
I mean, and also the photograph as a kind of facsimile of reality. How much was the book a matter of kind of corralling these various elements? Were there various levels in terms of the photograph kind of representing a sort of indecisive ability to take a decision?
Well, she's definitely like a wishy-washy character. She calls herself a half-widow. So she's trapped in between one place and another place, just like Martin is, just like all these people are. I think I talk about one foot in one door and one foot out the other, the other side frequently. So I don't, that's just who she is as a character. I mean, she doesn't know, she's afraid to make any specific decisions, and she's just been holding on for a really long time. But I think by the end she becomes much stronger and is able to make those decisions that she needs to make.
But in terms of symbols and dialogue and how these kind of reflect beyond her particular sort of character, what were there specific sort of levels of indecisiveness that made their way through the narrative as you were actually writing and concocting through this organic process of the novel?
Explain the question to me.
Okay. So, yes, we know that the character Jarvis is a rather indecisive sort.
Yeah.
So the question is, in to what degree were the symbols, such as a photograph that reflects a kind of reality that she only has a piece of,
yeah,
or the dialogue that I just quoted,
deliberate on my part?
Yeah, how conscious were you of that? How much did you plan it, or was it largely sort of a spontaneous situation?
I think I just get really obsessed with ideas and images, and they just sort of plant themselves in my head. And then I'm always amazed when I get to the end of a book and I feel like I've left this breadcrumb trail for myself, like when I've written it and I go, did I mean to do that? I have no idea. I mean, I'm always planting stuff. It's really subconscious for me. I don't, when I'm initially writing it and certain images pop up. And then I think once you get into the editing process and you have other people sort of point out stuff, like I know when my editor looked at it, she was like, oh, there's this, there's this, there's this. You know, you've got patterns here. You've got, you know, you might want to heighten this a little bit. Then it becomes more conscious. But I mean, I feel like when I sit down to write, it's really this sort of dreamlike state. It's not like automatic writing or anything like that, but I just get stuck on ideas. I don't know. It's not really a good answer to your question.
Well, I mean, let me give you an example. Alice is the name of the woman caught in a particular compromising position, which made me think of Charles Dodgson. So
well,
that
was deliberate.
Okay,
figured that one was
much.
Deliberate. Yeah.
Okay, so something like that is deliberate. How do you sort of find these things through the course?
But that
of
was like deliberate, like 3 drafts later. It was not like originally. Like I knew her name was Alice, and then I really had a couple different last names for her, and then for some reason I started thinking about Alice in Wonderland, and then I just looked it up and found out what the name was and everything like that. So it's there, I guess, but when I'm originally writing it, I can't say that I have the ideas there. I don't know. I can't explain it.
So really the original part of writing, the first draft, is really about getting to the end, and a lot of the revision process is more this aspect of finding, well, what the hell was this,
yes,
or why did I choose Alice and all that.
Exactly, yeah. And in terms of the photographs, I take photographs constantly. I'm always documenting every aspect of my life, which is actually a very sort of visual, I mean, a lot of visual artists are always having to do that. So it seemed like just a really natural place for me to start. I mean, I was really biking around and taking all pictures all the time when I was writing the book, and I've just been obsessed with Richard Avedon since I was in high school too. And I actually used the technique that he used to do In the American West. So I guess that was a deliberate thing. I mean, there was
you
references.
You note that in the acknowledgments. I was also going to ask you, were there any other photographic influences along these lines? Well, I mean, clearly Charles Dodgson to some degree.
There's just different artistic, you know, references, like the. Now, of course, I've forgotten his name. That's terrible. But there's a scene where there's a protest at a gallery show, and that was inspired by an old New York story about I can't remember the name of the artist. I'll have to let you know what it is. So there's like little artistic references here and there I would have to go and look at the book, and then I would be able to tell you what they are, you know?
Yeah, well, going back to, I'm jumping around with two thought processes here, but this idea of biking around Williamsburg, taking photos, was this of great help in terms of getting Jarvis's perspective? Do you have to do this do you have to essentially inhabit a protagonist to really write about her?
I think a little bit. I mean, the new book I'm working on now, it takes place in Nebraska, and I spent 6 weeks on a farm in Nebraska as a residency program last year. And so I really was like listening to people and walking the earth, and it's really helpful for me. Like, and I really do use pictures as a reference point. Like, I'll go back. I mean, I went to Mount St. Helens, and there's a couple scenes in the book in Mount St. Helens. And I was in Seattle that summer, and I drove down to Mount St. Helens, and I didn't know why I wanted to go, but I felt very much that I needed to have something in the book there. And I like that because that's a place of constant rebirth. Like there was like an explosion, and now they're like starting from scratch and rebuilding everything there. And it's a really fascinating place to go. And there was actually, I can say this, that Martin's parents were both conservative right-wing Christians. And I remember when I went to Mount St. Helens, I was on a path and I thought, oh, I really wish there was someone here that knew the history of it. And it turned out there were two people who were about Martin's parents' age. They were walking in front of me on the trail, and they started telling me, I used some of the dialogue from them and I in the book, and they started telling me all about the history, which is how I learned about it. And then they walked ahead of me on the trail, and I noticed they were both wearing T-shirts from their church. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, I just met Martin's parents, you know? And they were like the nicest people in the world, and I wanted that in the book to be not that the right-wing Christians were evil, yeah. you know, like that everybody was flawed, but that everyone loved this person. And then I was like, I met these two kind people who like gave me all of this information. And then when I went to go write that scene in the book, I took all the pictures that I had taken that day and I went through. And that was really like kind of an automatic writing process for me because I was looking, remembering the walk and just writing like what it looked like on the walk. And so it's really, it all, you know, for me, it's all part of one big art project that I do yeah. in this life, all the visual things and all the writing things and traveling and talking to people, it all comes together for me, I think.
Do you tape record these conversations? Do you take notes or is it all stem from the photography?
Notes sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't, like, I can never remember the specifics, I will say. I wish I did tape record, but then it seems a little bit like cheating. I don't know.
So you need a little bit of wiggle room to sort of at least have a kind of inventive quality to what you remember, basically.
Yeah, but I mean, as I get older, I forget stuff all the time. I wish I could. If I don't write it down right away, I probably don't remember it specifically. So yeah.
No, I can relate to that. I actually wanted to ask you also about Darcy Goldberg, who is the New York Times columnist in this. Was there any specific sort of... Hello.
Oh, the cat jumped.
That's all right. That's all right. I can do an interview with a cat sitting on my lap. No one specifically, or was there?
No, not really. I mean, it was kind of because she just shows up for a second. I mean, she's really just mentioned. So there isn't anyone that I was really. I don't read a lot of art criticism because I find most of it very dull. I guess maybe it's some people are good at it, but I just like to go and. I almost don't want to know too much about it. It's the same thing with photography. It's like, I never want to get really that good at it. You know, I don't want to take an art class. I don't want to take a photography class. I don't want to go into the studio. I just use digital cameras or whatever. I want to just have this one thing that I don't have to be amazing at because I feel so much pressure with my own, you know, with my writing. The cat is completely invaded the interview.
Oh, it's no problem. I'm still going to do this interview. Now, the vocation aspect of this, then, is something that you really don't want to know more that much about. You want to leave some things deliberately ambiguous because that's not your concern? Or what is the criteria that you set for not wanting to know about something as opposed
to... Well, I think that's why I had a character who was his muse rather than an artist herself. Mm-hmm. Sort of, that was like an easy way out. Like, I didn't have to know, like, you know, write about the, you know... the paintbrush specifically or anything. But I did do some research, like with the Richard Avedon photography stuff. Like I read, you know, his essays where he talked about his process, and I consulted with a couple photographers that I knew so that I was describing it, you know, making sure I was describing all the equipment accurately. And there was actually one little touch where, because I guess in the Avedon process, he uses this gigantic camera, and he would pull, it was like these huge pieces of film that he had to pull out. And so I think in the final end, I had Jarvis assisting him a little bit sometimes because I was like, wow, that's a huge piece of equipment. He would need some help with that. So like maybe at the, you know, fifth draft, she suddenly became his assistant.
I also wanted to ask you, and it's kind of in relation to this, the difference between the literal meaning of something and the metaphorical meaning of something. Jarvis, for example, says at one point, "I am still flush with the notion of family, the red rosy hues of Missy's life." The red... Rosie Hughes of Missy's life, tinting my cheeks. Sorry, the cat's here. Uh-huh. So I wanted to ask you about this because this is kind of a way for Jarvis to connect, but essentially it's a metaphor as opposed to literal, and this happens throughout the book. Was this something that you kind of just wanted to heighten up through the course of revision? Was this something that you wanted to do to sort of show that she doesn't really have this kind of literal grasp or this understanding of the reality in front of her?
I just think you're giving me way too much credit here. I just like write images that sound good to me. I mean, I was originally a poet, so for me, like, everything feels like a metaphor when I'm writing. Like, everything comes out that way. So it was not like a conscious think. I mean, thanks. I'm glad you like think I'm smart. I'm not that. I don't know.
No. There's no need to beat yourself up here. The other thing is going back to this idea. This cat is just.
You want
crazy.
Me to get him?
No. Actually, this is a very idiosyncratic aspect of the interview. I'm determined to try to do this with the cat in this position. This has never happened before.
Crack but any come here. Get off of him.
But anyway, this idea of having a real hands-on grasp of. Doing research, going out on a bicycle, taking pictures, versus cat's ass is now in my face.
Okay, come here, Cracker. Yeah. Go ahead, keep talking.
Versus the notion, I mean, what wiggle room do you leave for invention then, basically?
Oh my gosh, a lot. I don't know. I mean, I just had, like, once you, like, are comfortable in, I guess, going back to the topography, like, once you're comfortable in that space, or once you're comfortable with a character, you have to have something that's really, really strong, I think, a really strong baseline. And then you feel, and you just write it out until you get to that point where you feel like, and then anything can happen on top of that, mm-hmm. you know? So I think there's tons of, I mean, there's so many characters in here that I came up with out of scratch, so... You know, or and there's some characters that are like a little bit of this person, a little bit of that person, or a line that somebody said, you know, here and there. But I think it's all invention in a way, you know.
Is there a risk in writing about a character who is essentially this passive throughout a good chunk of the book as opposed to being active, where mm-hmm. you can actually kind of have conflict or Freytag's triangle or whatever you want to call it? What do you do to sort of, I guess, keep that sort of spirit alive?
It's so weird because I don't think of her as that. I think of her as stuck, but I don't necessarily think of her as passive because she's doing a lot of things and you're learning about her past too. So that sort of probably energizes a little bit. But she's going out and meeting people. She's sort of coming out of her shell. To me, it's like, it couldn't only have started there. It could only have started her, with her meeting those three men and suddenly realizing that there had to be, I guess the first third, she sort of doesn't quite realize there has to be a huge change. But I don't know. She doesn't feel like that passive of a person to me. She's got such a spirit inside of her was just waiting to be lit, I suppose.
There is, though, I mean, some reviewers, including Anna Clark from the San Francisco Chronicle, she remarked on the sort of jarring emotional discordance throughout the book, specifically highlighting the transition from part one to part two, where Jarvis is in a rage and then she is then at the laundromat doing reggae. And I wanted to sort of ask you about this, or at least give you, you know, an opportunity to sort of respond to this thing, because there is actually, I kind of partially agree with her that there is a lot of discordance going on, possibly because she's extremely confused and trying to come to terms with her emotions. But this also sort of is something that I'm kind of curious about in terms of making sure that the, how consistent do you have to be with a protagonist like this?
Well, I've been told not to respond to my reviewers, even if I don't agree with their reviews. So
who told you this?
You're not supposed to respond to your criticism, so I don't have anything to say really about it.
Well, what about this nature of emotional discordance within the character?
I mean, she's trying to figure out her life, you know, it's not always going to be the same. And I thought it was, to me, it made perfect sense that the way that part one ended and the way part two began. Like, it allowed you to have a little bit of breath, take a little bit of time. It teased you a little bit. You didn't need to know right away what was in that, you know, what the mystery was. I don't want to give it away, you know. So, I mean, to me, that was rhythmically made perfect sense to me. I guess that's all I can say.
Well, I mean, there's a method to my madness here, because I wanted to actually jump off of this onto the idea of a sort of expected response from some readers wanting for a narrative consistency, and then the sort of jarring inconsistency of life sort of tossing you curveballs. There's sort of a kind of aspect of this, which is why I wanted to sort of ask you about this. Where do you sort of negotiate this particular line?
I just feel like you freak out and then you like calm down and then you freak out again and you deal with it and stuff. I mean, it just doesn't seem like, I don't know, it just makes sense to me. That's all. I don't know how to answer besides that.
Well, maybe let me try to rephrase this in another manner. I mean, the nature of life isn't always the same as the nature of the book, which has sort of a kind of preordained structure that you're sort of setting, whereas life is not necessarily like that. You don't often have control over certain aspects that happen in your life, whereas as a novelist, you do, in fact. And yet you sort of embrace more of this kind of inconsistent approach in this book, which is a bit different from a lot of other novelists, which is why I wanted to sort of ask you where you negotiate that line.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I can't answer the question. I just like... It just I think is about rhythms, I would say, for me. Like when I look at what I write, I look at pacing and I look at timing and where you might say that it's being inconsistent. I see it as consistent with the larger structure of the book. So it's just that one, you know, if people want to talk about the end of part one and the beginning of part two, I mean, I had someone else say to me. Actually, I've had a friend say to me that you can't. believe your good reviews and you can't believe your bad reviews. So, or you have to believe them both. So either way, you're kind of screwed, you know what I mean? But you do have to, you do read the reviews. But I did have someone say to me that they really liked that they liked that leap. And I don't know, I think a smart reader, because that's a horrible thing to say. I think somebody will be willing to go along with the ride. I would hope that they would be willing to go along for the ride in the book.
Well, it goes back to the inevitable situation where each person who reads your book is going to bring their own particular perspective, their own particular sort of take. So in that sense, really, no, but I mean, it's not a matter of what could you do. It's interesting to me to sort of see how someone can infer this particular idea of there being a sort of emotional consistency, which is why I asked the question in terms of emotional consistency of life versus the sort of expected consistency of a novel. So that's kind of what I'm sort of suggesting. I'm not trying to judge the book.
No, I think it's like, I think it's perfectly consistent with her, mm-hmm. with who she is, just because people wouldn't act in the same way. To me, it seems like very exactly what this character would have done in that situation, you know? So, I don't know.
In fact, now that we're on the sort of subject of judgment, I mean, in terms of Jarvis, there's a sort of interesting kind of moral judgment that she brings to each given situation in the terms of who she decides to care for, who she decides to, you know, get involved with in certain sorts of, you know, acts, which I won't describe, so I won't give anything away.
Yeah.
Did you set any kind of rules on this level in terms of how she judges and how she thinks?
Well, she's really flawed. Like, she's just such an intensely flawed character. And she was actually written a lot sort of meaner, I guess.
Really?
And then through the editing process, she got softened up a little bit. But to me, she's really, you know, very edgy and harsh, and the, you know, she's the kind of woman who needs a man to make her feel good about herself. Who's that? Who wants to be that person? But there's so many women out there like that. To me, she's incredibly weak in a lot of ways, but she's learning how to become stronger, and she's learning how to find her identity. So, no, but I've certainly met women like that, and that's where the, you know, I mean, that's where the rules are, I guess.
Why did you decide to soften the character? I'm curious.
I think that it was a decision to make her a little bit more empathetic and more appealing to an audience. And so you'd be willing to go along with the ride. Like, she does a lot of screwed up things in the book, but if I were to make her a little bit nicer, then people would be willing to go all the way to the end. I didn't want anyone throwing the book across the room and saying, well, I just don't even like her. You know, and that's a challenge, you know.
But there's also this idea of being true to life and being true to sort of a flawed person. How did you negotiate that particular balance between likability and actually making this character really screwed up?
She's still pretty unlikable, I think, so. But there were just, like, really calculated things that she would say.
Like what, for example?
I can't remember anymore. They've been excised, so. But she was definitely crueler. I mean, that's just what
Well, what kind of cruelty was she doing? I'm really curious.
I know. I'm trying to remember what it would be. I think it was just in, like, things that she would say, or the way that she would look at someone and, you know, not like what they were wearing, mm-hmm. or... I still have that in there a little bit. Like, she just, like, hates what Martin's mother wears all the time throughout the book. I think it's really a funny little gag, but
I mean, was she boiling hamsters or something?
No. She was just sort of tougher, really, like, very, like, New York-y mm-hmm. tough. And I made her a little bit nicer along the way. There were just certain edges. There was probably obscenities that were excised, a couple body parts that we took out here and there. So
really, wow.
Yeah.
Wow, like throbbing members?
That would be more tolerable probably than anything else. So she's still there. Anytime you go through an editing process with a novel, like, it is definitely a give and take. Like, you have to go, well, I'll trade you two, you know, like, I'll get rid of, you know, two instances of the word vagina if, you know, I'll
really
or whatever, you know, like that kind of thing. Like, you just want to, like, figure out how to maintain. Yeah, of course. I'm certain you've heard this before.
Well, yeah, I have. But I'm also curious as to what, you know, if there are certain publishers that have problems with the word vagina, which I happen to think is a lovely word myself.
I know, it's great. No. But that's not, like, the right example, because the word vagina does appear.
Yes, it does.
Book,
it does. So, I was about to say, I was wondering if there were more to vaginas at some point.
So that kind of, I don't know, that kind of thing, though. You know, like, you just go through and go, well, this is maybe too much or too harsh or whatever it is. I mean, if you want it to be, if you want to go all out, I mean, and write, like, you know, sort of this, like, really pure evil kind of, or harsh or dark book, you have to go, like, with a small press. And that's, you know, anyone will tell you that. Yeah. So once you, like, go through with a mainstream publisher, there are certain, you know, but the trade-off is that you have, well, first of all, I really love my publisher. I think they're fantastic. They've been incredibly supportive. All the books they put out, they love, I love, I just think they're really fantastic. So, you know, the trade-off is that you get this, like, huge distribution, which I think the most important things in the book are there, and I'm really proud of it. And so I'm happy to, you know, do this and that, which to me seems really like a minor thing to do.
Do you have any regrets, perhaps, for not going through a small press? I mean, are there pros and cons of each particular sort of situation?
I mean, I have these, like, dreams of, because I started out small press.
Yeah.
And I read books here and there that are just so, you know, dark and amazing, and I do have like a real dark side to me and to my writing. But I think that, you know, I could just write my, like, dirty little short stories and put them up on Nerve, and that sort of fulfills that need for me for now. It's just been such a great experience with Riverhead that I really wouldn't want to go anywhere else. So.
Okay. I also wanted to ask you about Missy the cab driver and how it's this kind of working class component against this sort of privileged class component. How did that come about? Did that come about sort of from the early drafts? Or?
Yeah, Missy was always there. Well, you know, I had this... I deal a lot with Craigslist because I travel a lot and I sublet my apartment a lot. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I meet people over Craigslist and there was who come to the apartment, and there was this woman who came one day who was not Missy at all. But she told me some stuff about herself and her family, and she had a little girl, and she just wanted to sublet the place so she would have a place to come and write her poetry. Mm-hmm. And she was Puerto Rican, she was from the neighborhood, and she worked, like, for a financial company, I think. And I liked the idea of a character who just wanted, like, a little writer's studio for themselves for, like, you know, 2 weeks or something like that, just so she could get away from her family. So originally I think she was a poet, and then that got slashed because it was sort of, like, a little over the top. But I think, like, you just have, like, all... As I was saying earlier about, like, going to your bodega and going to your laundromat and going to your local bar or restaurant, like, I have so many relationships with people who are who in my neighborhood who are nothing like me and who are really important. So it, to me, it was like if I got to go home with them one day, that was Missy in the book. If I got to go home with them and really hang out with them and spend a lot of time with them, and when you're a single New York woman living by yourself, I do have a boyfriend, but when you're a single person, you really depend on these people in your daily life. And you know that fear that people have of, like, dying alone in their apartment? Have you ever, do you know that? Like, that's, like, totally, like, the single girl fear. Like, yeah. My body's going to be, you know, sitting in this apartment for 3 months and no one's going to know I'm here. Actually, my next door neighbor, that happened, and we didn't know for 5 days until the smell came through. Yeah. That's, I think, why we rely so much on these people, like, so somebody will know if you're not there, if you, you know.
But in terms of relying upon them as a novelist, I'm wondering how you do that.
Well, she was great. She was the only person who was, she was slightly held back, but then she, by the end of the book, she wasn't. She was the smartest one, you know?
This may make it seem like a sort of tryout contest, a little talent show.
Well, you know, you try out like a character. No, she was really good because she got Jarvis around, and I thought she was really lovely. Like, I just thought she had, like, really lovely stories and a really lovely life, and I was really, I liked spending time with her. I mean, it was very comforting when I got to write stuff about her because I didn't think she wanted anything from Jarvis, and she was probably the only person who didn't want anything. I mean, some of the other characters didn't, but she was just, like, wanted to be a friend. She was a friend to her. And that was really nice. That's what she needed. That's what Jarvis needed more than anything. She did not need those men, really. You know, she needed a woman like that who relies on men to make her feel good about herself really just needs more female friends in her life.
The fear of dying alone, was this sort of an aspect that kind of fed into the continuing sort of nature of Jarvis?
The fear of dying alone.
That you were just describing.
Well, it was really, when my neighbor died, it really did, it was really terrible, and it really did strike me. And this was something that was really strange, was he and I used to IM. He went crazy was happened at the end, and he was on painkillers, and he was much older. He was this computer guy, and he started flooding our apartments and things like that, and that's when we knew he was real. I'd go over, and he'd be standing in a foot of water, and he was just really out of it. But we had, for a long time, had IM'd, and then after he passed away, his IM still kept popping up on my screen. It was like the strangest thing. I don't know how exactly if his computer was still on or whatever it was. And people haunt you, you know, for like a long time. So dying alone, I don't think I'm going to, I think they would find my body within a day. Yeah. I'm pretty confident.
Well, I mean, why should that be a concern? Because if you're, I mean, I'm also trying to sort of relate this in a sort of way to how Jarvis's mind sort of thinks. Because her sort of main problem is if she would just kind of accept herself, then there wouldn't be this particular sort of issue of constantly sort of dredging up the past. And, oh, you know, I never even asked you about why this was written in the present. And maybe you can talk about a little bit about the sort of relationship between the past and the present in terms of this book. I've just thrown about four questions at you, but go for it.
I don't know. Why did I write it in the present? I just wanted people to know exactly what she was feeling at that moment. And like that there was no chance to second guess what she was feeling. Okay, so that was one. Okay, what was the next question?
I think we were talking about the sort of relationship between how this neighbor and the fear of dying alone pertains to Jarvis to a large degree, and how you sort of tapped into this, and whether this was actually something that was as pivotal as bicycling around Williamsburg and that kind of.
Well, I did have I had a lot of death like all at once. I had a friend who died who was an artist, and he had a motorcycle accident. He died on New Year's Eve about 20 blocks away from here. Or 15 or something like that. And he was on my mind a lot too. Probably him more than my neighbor. I don't know. I mean, it's a lonely city. And I think when I was writing it, I was getting out of I had just gotten out of a relationship, so I was spending a lot of time by myself too. So sometimes it's easier to fixate on other things than to admit how lonely you are yourself. It's easier to fixate on a husband in a coma. It's easier to fixate on writing a novel than, you know, to think about your ex-boyfriend or something like that. I don't know if I'm really answering your questions. I'm just telling you.
It answers
I don't really. I can just tell you, like, really, like, basic kind of, you know, base kind of stuff about me. But when you ask me to, like, consider my book, because I keep going back to it, it's really, it's so subconscious for me that I don't know it until the end. It's always amazing to read reviews or when people read the book and point things out to me and I'm like, oh, I guess I did that. I don't know, you know?
But every writer goes through this notion of, absolutely. That's exactly what I
intended. Right. I can't really lie. I mean, my editor will find stuff
that's
too. Really,
or that's an interesting observation. I hadn't a clue. Yeah. I mean, this is every single novelist I have talked to experiences this kind of thing.
Oh, that's good.
So it doesn't matter, you know, how great or humble your intentions are. It's an ongoing sort of predicament.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you sort of deal with this? Does this kind of affect the meaning of your own writing, or do you just sort of kind of slough it off?
I don't really think about it very much. It's about, Keith Christensen says that an author should have an internal compass and that you just follow that. And at a certain point, you just stop listening to what everybody else says and then you just write what you want to write. And I totally agree with that. Like, I know which direction, I know when I'm going in the right direction and when I'm not, I get a little queasy, a little seasick, if you will. Yeah.
Well, in terms of, since you're going to bring up Kate Christensen, I will have to ask, because The Great Man and The Kept Man are very sort of similar in subject matter. I mean, were you aware of The Great Man when you were writing this?
No, or is I didn't it pure know serendipity? Her. I mean, I didn't know her. And the day that I got my galley, I went to a book party and I met her at the book party. And we were talking and we were sort of like, whoa, hi, you know. And it was a week before her book came out.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, oh yeah, I just got my galley. And she said, do you want me to blurb it? And I was like, yes, I want you to blurb it. So she read it like in a weekend. And then I read her book the next week. And we were both sort of like, whoa, this is really, really strange that we have all these similar elements. And we live about, you know, a little bit over a mile away from each other on the waterfront and all that kind of stuff. So we've since become friends. And she's really a great resource for me and a great friend. A great friend and a great writer friend, which is, you know, almost more important sometimes, you know, the great writer friend that you can talk to about your work and share things. But we didn't know, and we sort of are wondering why we did, but we just did, you know. Mm.
again, you never know that sort of great intent, you know, the subconscious point.
I know. Her book, I think, is really great. So, and but it's very, but our books are very different. They have a lot in common.
Sure.
But one of the things is that her Oscar, somebody, I think it's like his mistress or maybe it's his sister, they're it's about, her book is about an artist who is dead and the three women who, three most important women in his life, and they sort of reflecting on him. And they're talking about the artists that he influenced in, that are real life artists. And those were, some of those artists were artists that I had taken from as inspiration for Martin's work.
Yeah.
And I was like, ah!
I'm telling you, all novelists who live in this area, there's going to actually be a number of books with the blank man, and they'll all be dealing with the art world in some way.
Right.
I can see a sort of grand army of
we'll all be women in our late 30s, early 40s.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, Jamie, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Okay. I'm your man.
I'm your man.
It's okay.